People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A new audio drama warns of the danger of elder financial abuse. Have a listen.
Welcome to Beware Mysterious Mark. This 10-part series is a harrowing, true account of elder financial abuse. Some of what you'll hear may be unsettling. That's intentional. Because this can happen to anyone, your parent, your partner, your friend.
Over the last 7 years, we've witnessed and experienced the systematic ruination of Brooke's family. Little sly trick by little sly trick, nasty lying comment by nasty lying comment, by one man.
Brooke, this is about the annihilation of your family. Not only is your dad being financially exploited, but his life's being controlled. He's a captive in his own home.
The producer of the series says loneliness can be a gap exploited by predators. I spoke with Bill Collins about using radio drama to bring awareness to elder financial abuse.
Hi, my name is Bill Collins. I'm a producer here at Radio Sydney. Radio Sydney comes to you from the Mary Winspear Centre in downtown beautiful Sydney by the Sea, southern Vancouver Island. And we're an online-only radio with big dreams of being FM at some point. But today, we serve our local community and bring forward issues that are of concern locally for sure and perhaps well across Canada, if the truth be told.
And you have been the producer on something that is happening, that is unfolding, rolling out right now in May and June. Radio Sydney presents the 10-part documentary series, Beware Mysterious Mark. Good old-fashioned radio drama about elder financial abuse. Where did this come from?
Yeah, it came from a connection that I made in the community with an individual that told me about the story in its outline form. And I was very intrigued. And then later, after a few more conversations, I realized the depth of what they were transmitting in terms of the depth of the story, the passion, the challenges involved in the story. And I thought, wow, this would be an amazing story to bring to air. And around the same time, as Radio Sydney quite often does, it looks for funding mechanisms for projects. And we've done a few of those in the past. But one project funding support came from New Horizons for Seniors Canada. It's a federal government organization, and it looks to support activities from the community that drive deeper connections to seniors and seniors connecting seniors or seniors connecting with other folks in the community. And one priority item that was targeted there was elder financial abuse. And I thought, okay, we've got the story. And we've got a way to support the development of the story and to bring it forward as a radio show and along with expert commentary. And that's how the seed germinated. And a year later, we're now listening to it.
And can you give me a little bit of info about what exactly people are hearing in this 10-part series? So there is Albert, who is the kind of elderly dad character. And what exactly happens to him?
Yeah, it's a scary story. And the context for why this is important, perhaps, Joe, to your listeners, is that in Canadian, in terms of Canadian history, right now we're experiencing the largest intergenerational transfer of wealth. By some estimates, there's $1 trillion that will be handed down from parents to children. Oh, it's already started. So, of course, that leaves a lot of money up for grabs if you happen to be a predator. So this story does really two things. It presents the true story. We call it the harrowing true account of elder financial abuse. But it presents it in a way that we think people will get more information out of just the story. So while the dialogue is excellent, it is a traditional kind of radio play. With each episode, there are certain themes that are addressed. And we've chosen the dialogue to reflect those themes, everything from loneliness to powers of attorney to things the medical profession can do with respect to capacity as people age. So we bring together experts to discuss and provide some guidance with respect to the themes that occur on each episode. So those expert opinions came from the research that we've done here at Radio Sydney to interview these experts, to bring forward ideas that can help folks if they're concerned that their loved one or their neighbor is being predated upon. So that's the structure of it. So this is delivered over 10 parts. The story is largely chronological, and it is based on transcripts that were collected during the course of the writer's interaction with the predator. So everything we bring to you is accurate and true and unbelievable.
What are some of the actual mechanics of how this scam, or maybe these scams more broadly, tend to play out?
Right. So there's really, as the researchers for this show, we're not experts. We are experts in this story only. However, what I would say is there's a couple of different dimensions to the whole financial elder abuse scenario. Number one is we hear of it all the time on the news, somebody losing their life savings or getting scammed out of this. In fact, after the first episode aired, I had a call from somebody that said, I was just in a convenience store in Vancouver. There happened to be an ATM Bitcoin machine. An elderly gentleman was standing up trying to get the thing to work with his phone in one hand. And this wonderful, bold person said to me that I went over, approached him and asked him if I could help. And he said his bank was on the line and they were instructing him to put money into the ATM machine. So she quickly asked him to hand the phone over, which he kindly did. And within 2 seconds, the scammer was gone. Fortunately, the actions of this person thwarted the attempt by the scammers. In fact, Joe, what's interesting about the scam aspect of things is the federal government of Canada has just banned Bitcoin ATMs, or will put in place the process of banning Bitcoin ATMs for this very reason. So there's the scam. And our story is slightly different. We describe it as the long con. So here is late middle age, so 70s something, a man and his wife connected at a friend level with a senior, an elderly senior, but very active elderly senior who was out walking and riding his bike, and they stuck up a friendship. With very quickly, the man, sensing this fellow wanted to be a friend, told him a lot of information, which allowed that predator to formulate the plan. And over the next 6 years, the predator and his partner gained access to the man's assets, got on the title of the house, and drew a wedge between the father and the only daughter, who was obviously part of a very healthy, strong bonded family unit initially. And so that predator destroyed trust, broke that family bond, and ended up with a lot of the family assets through the friendship, quote unquote friendship that they developed with this elderly gentleman.
And one of the harrowing parts of listening to this in radio documentary form or radio play form is that you can hear it playing out, and you can hear the people who are impacted see that this is happening, becoming increasingly worried and concerned that worse things are going to continue to happen, and that their efforts to try and do something about it are often thwarted, or are often, for example, one of the themes that emerges from the documentary you've put together is if you're concerned that your elderly parent has this weird friendship with someone and you're assertive about it and you tell them off and you tell them you don't think it's a good idea, then there's a tendency for people to kind of dig their heels in.
Yeah, this was the advice coming from a number of professionals, where by confronting the abused individual, you really put them in a defensive mode. They have to defend this friendship from attack. So many of the experts says, you know, don't make your father upset. Be gentle. Don't push too hard because you'll only push him further from you and towards the predator. I don't know myself. I feel the frustration came through as part of this story. You know, Joe, what was also interesting was as the actors were reading some of the parts, when they saw what was happening, they would be visibly angry. And so it comes through in some of the dialogue where you can tell an individual is being preyed upon and there's nothing you can do. I mean, in this case, you'll hear it in the future episodes, the RCMP was approached by 5 different individuals in the community, some professional, some worried family members and neighbors. And the RCMP did 2 wellness checks. And the constable knew there was something happening, but it didn't reach the threshold of criminality. And this was the most frustrating component. And, well, I mean, as you listen to the story, you'll hear the anger coming out in the voice actors because it was true and in the room. And everybody, you know, took a deep breath after some of the scenes.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. I'm speaking with Bill Collins of Radio Sydney. He's the producer of Beware Mysterious Mark, a 10-part audio drama focused on elder financial abuse. You mentioned there this plot point in the story where people go to the police and they're basically told, well, no one's committed a crime yet, so we can't actually do anything really much to help you. What are some of the other maybe mechanics of our systems that this story exposes that are maybe allowing situations like this to unfold?
Right. So we often talk about confidentiality. So in some of these instances, confidentiality is not your friend. The specific example is as the predator was marching the elderly gentleman, Albert, as he was marching Bert to various notaries to try and get the title severed on the house, or at least he wanted to transfer his portion of the house to the predator. He went to the notaries, and one notary in particular, one of the first ones, noticed the aggressive nature of the predator, found what they were trying to do was just completely unethical and wrong, and then notified a lot of their notaries' public colleagues that beware, this is happening. And my advice is to, you know, kick them out of your office or something like that. Whereas if you go to a lawyer and you engage the lawyer to help you do these acts, which is legal, believe it or not, you can sever title on a house on certain tenancies or common holdings. You can sever title on a house without the 50% owner knowing, the other 50% owner knowing, which shocked me. However, what we, in terms of the legal profession, because of confidentiality, they couldn't warn their other lawyers that this was going to happen, particularly as the predator started with folks that Bert knew. Ultimately, they found a lawyer that didn't bother to do the checking in the back on who other was titled, didn't bother to do the due diligence, nor are they required necessarily, even in terms of the BC Law Society ethics, to do the background check. Although I believe most people would say, yeah, I should at least find out who the other owner is on the house if I'm going to sever the title. In any case, because lawyers couldn't say anything to other lawyers, they eventually found a lawyer that would agree to sever the title. So in this case, confidentiality did not help. And I would also say our expert, Charlotte Salomon, lawyer from the Western communities and very important in estate planning, she noted that the best things that families can do if they're concerned about interlopers coming in is to prepare, first of all, the legal documents that frame out how an individual may want their estate to be managed in the event that they become incapable of making financial decisions. So her recommendation was transparency. So if you're going to create a will, tell your children. If your spouse is still alive, tell your spouse, this is what you plan to do. Make it all transparent so that in the event that a predator comes in, then at least you can go and you can say to your parents, look, this is what we all agreed to. Are you sure you want to change this now? And they would get the same advice from a legal professional or an estate planning professional. Are you sure? Which also leads to the question of capacity. And this is another thing and mechanics that experts came to the table with. How do you actually define when someone is incapable of making a financial decision? And that's a sort of an accounting, a legal framework, versus making a decision that might be capable of making, for example, and how they want their medical issues to be treated or not treated. So there are assessment tools, and our professional, our geriatrician, Dr. Josh Budlovsky, was very articulate in telling folks, here's what the medical profession looks to when they want to try and decide capacity. So in addition, we interviewed a lawyer from Ontario who has developed something called the Canadian Center for Decision-Making Capacity, which is a professional not-for-profit that tries to help professionals in the business of trying to understand either medically or legally what capacity means, to provide a more standardized template across the board. So those folks always talk about it's not a simple decision to make. And secondly, you don't want to unduly take decision-making powers away from somebody. So there has to be a really strong reason to do that. Otherwise, you will err on the side of allowing them to make decision. And here's the other nuance to this. You want to be able to give people as they age the ability to make decisions if they're capable of making those decisions. Whether they're bad or good decisions, that's not necessarily up for anybody else to determine. You could have a father that's perfectly capable of making a bad decision. The children may not agree with that decision, but you have to allow that individual, if they're able to do so, to make those decisions, bad or good. So that's the barrier, the fine line that medical and legal professionals try to understand as they're trying to assess capacity. And of course, elderly decisions around where I'm going to live are different than elderly decisions around where I want to invest my, you know, money.
How did you look at that line in terms of this story when you were putting together the radio play and attempting to kind of convey this issue of elder financial abuse through it?
Yeah. First of all, in order to frame up the discussion, I interviewed, which never made it to air, but I interviewed Isabel McKenzie, who is a former seniors advocate for the province of BC. And I think she summed it up by saying, look, the system is good, but it has challenges in certain areas. So there is a fairly big gray area that could perhaps and should perhaps be tightened up. So I view it as just not a straightforward path from A to B with a ton of nuance. And so that's why the folks that talk in terms of legal positions or medical positions want to make sure they're covering all the bases. So for me, it was pretty clear that Bert was unduly influenced by Mark. If you just take the evidence at face value, it was clear with beyond a shadow of a doubt, in my view, that this was happening. But I can understand from, say, a geriatrician, perhaps with the medical team making the decision that, yep, Bert was not capable of making the decision right now. And that doesn't mean it's forever. That because maybe physical issues might impact the mental health issues that somebody's trying to make decisions. So these aren't black and white in time, nor in which way you fall on capacity or non-capacity. So these are the gray areas that I felt were gray, and I'm not sure public policy is at the right place to be able to help with this. Clearly as evidenced by this particular story, but in general, and Nathan Spaulding of the Capacity Clinic talks about providing frameworks, more consistent frameworks across Canada for making these decisions. And maybe we will start to build a team approach. Now, in some jurisdictions, it is a team. A medical team will get together with a legal team and make the assessment known in the best interest of the individual, but sometimes it's siloed. And very specifically in this particular story, a team of professionals had deemed the man, Bert, incapable of making financial decisions. Yet, because that letter was not known to the lawyer made the decision based on some guidance by the predator. He made the decision that Bert was capable of making those decisions, and therefore he was available to make the change in the title of his ownership. Interestingly enough, the banks were the most stalwart in this story, because the bank, if there was any hint of undue influence, the bank shut things down. They wouldn't have the conversation. Eventually, in this story, the bank froze Bert's assets so that the predators couldn't suck the money out of his accounts, which they wanted to do, and eventually said that we really don't want to have you as a customer, Bert, because we feel you're being unduly influenced. And you can imagine, you know, a predator as the buddy-buddy with Bert, Mark, buddy-buddy with Bert, shows up at a teller in a local bank branch and says, Bert wants to make me joint on his account. And very aggressive with the teller, and the bank teller said, just a second, I'll talk to my manager. The manager came in, and the conversation quickly was apparent what was trying to happen. The bank manager says, nope, not going to let this happen. So in this case, the bank, in my view, and other banks are the same, have this approach whereby you need to have the right kind of legal structure in order to make these decisions as you age. And it's a protection mechanism for their clients. And obviously, they don't want to be held responsible for making decisions that shouldn't have happened. In any case, I was very impressed by the bank's response to this story.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Bill Collins of Radio Sydney. He's the producer of Beware Mysterious Mark. It's a 10-part radio drama based on a story of elder financial abuse. The series is airing on Thursday nights on Radio Sydney through July. You can catch up on the episodes already out on YouTube, Spotify, or at mark.radiosydney.ca. The charitable society Seniors First BC runs a seniors abuse and information line that's available weekdays from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Their number is 1-866-437-1940. So there's the bank's response on one hand, there are all the complications of the legal system's response to this, and its kind of intersection with the medical system's determination of when someone is able to make decisions for themselves or not. Ultimately, if you were trying to offer advice to someone on how they could prevent this from happening to someone they loved, or you know, if this was happening in the very early stages, what they could do, what advice would you have for them?
Right. So first of all, Joe, I'm the radio producer. I'm not the expert in any of these things. So what I have learned, however, from the experts are a couple of things. First of all, transparency, as I mentioned earlier with Charlotte Salomon talking about transparency, about what you're doing, so that everybody knows and is part and parcel of the decisions that you make, if possible. The other thing, and this was really poignant, an opinion by Dr. Eric Partridge, who is an expert in loneliness. And to me, vulnerable, lonely individuals, particularly elderly and particularly on their own, are a target for predators because of that loneliness. So chronic loneliness, according to Dr. Partridge, is the same impact on your physical health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So that try to put things in perspective. I've never smoked, so I couldn't tell you what that's like, but I can only imagine. And so chronic loneliness is something that's not necessarily depression, although they may come hand in hand. What this is a sort of an aching in the heart because you don't have the kind of connection that you would like to have in your life, connections to any number of things. So what Eric told us was, well, first of all, one way to avoid loneliness or to try and counteract or mitigate loneliness is touching. So if you have somebody, an acquaintance, a friend or whatever, touching you on the shoulder, shaking your hand, that kind of thing, that's really important for that individual to make the connection. Well, there's that physical connection, lights up other parts of your brain. The second is storytelling. So people telling stories allows them to make a connection to you and the broader community. So how many times have you might have gone to visit an elderly person and they're telling you the same story 10 times? Well, the fact is, let them tell the story. Don't stop them and saying, well, you told me that before. No, what they want is that connection through that storytelling. And that's very important. And the third component of mitigating loneliness is practicing gratitude. Now, this is an area that I only learned about through my conversations, but it's essentially just to take a step back and say, look, there may be many challenges in my life, but maybe there's a few things that I can do to make me feel a little better. So he said, one person practicing gratitude, like journaling and those sorts of things, diaries are all in one element of practicing gratitude. But another, something simple as a person took a few pictures a day on their phone and some point in the evening stopped and had a look at those pictures to make the connection with maybe what they did as positive in their day. So those kinds of connections are very important to thwart loneliness. Another factoid, Joe, the half-life of a phone call or a visit with somebody senior is maybe 2 to 3 days. After that, you'll quite often hear the senior saying, no one comes to visit me anymore, when in fact you might have been there 2 days ago. So we need to, particularly with the elderly more vulnerable in our population, we need to continue to try to find ways in our daily lives to make those connections with our elders. And that will be a major way to reduce loneliness. And loneliness, by the way, is you may be the most active person in the world. You may have bridge. You may have volunteering at the food bank. You may have knitting clubs. You may have book clubs. All of these things in your day. But at the end of the day, if you come back to an empty house, as one person described to Eric Partridge, then you feel that weight on you for loneliness. So just because you're active doesn't mean you're not lonely. So that's another cue for anybody that's wondering about whether their parent might be lonely. And loneliness, that we say in this, what this show has taught me, was that loneliness is a gap that can be exploited by predators.
Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of this being a radio play. You've already shared one story of a call you got from a listener. Have you been hearing more feedback from people as this is going out?
Yes, we have. I've been receiving emails almost daily from folks that want to tell their story. Again, you know, maybe it's part of the storytelling, is part of the healing, although I expect many people are telling me the story because they want to know what actions to take. I don't have the answers for them. So on the markdoc.ca website, we provide a bunch of resources that folks can take advantage of in order to deal with their particular situation. But I think what I'm getting is the sense that this is an unreported story, as many of the organizations that have reported out on elder financial abuse have indicated. It's unreported. So the kinds of stories that we have that I've been hearing are grassroots. We're trying to collect those stories now. Maybe there will be follow on. We've got a couple of ideas on how to follow on the project, which I'll be happy to sort of share with you. But ultimately, the stories are sad. And the only thing that we can do is arm them with what the experts say. And the first and foremost advice is, if you're at all concerned, go see a lawyer. Go talk to a lawyer. They will put things in perspective. They may tell you there's nothing that we can do for you, but at least you're trying to do something to support yourself getting out of a situation that you're not happy with or that you're concerned about.
Well, as you point out there, the crux of this story, at the kernel of it, is something that is quite sad. You're sharing that the stories you're hearing from people are quite sad. When you actually go and listen to the radio documentary, it's compelling. You want to, an episode finishes and you want to hear the next one. But if you're just talking to someone and telling them, we've made this radio play about senior financial elder abuse, they might say, well, that sounds rather sad. How do you sell someone on listening to the series?
Well, it is sad. There's no happy ending in this story. That's a spoiler alert. Not like you'd like to see. This isn't Hollywood. This is true from southern Vancouver Island. But I would say awareness as our narrator, Barry Bowman, the indubitable Barry Bowman from Mornings Radio, is our wonderfully supportive announcer here with the traditional radio voice. Barry was great in helping support this project. Wonderful man, by the way, and still very active in the radio community. As Barry points out, our goal is not to shock you, although some of the information is shocking, and you may not feel comfortable with the story, but awareness is your first line of defense.
And you mentioned that you have some ideas for potential follow-on projects on this. Could you tell me a little bit about those?
Sure. Some of the things that are motoring around in the noodle box with here at Radio Sydney is we're thinking about producing a companion book so that many seniors might find, hard of hearing, that may not catch every word in the dialogue, because as I mentioned, some of it gets pretty intense. A companion book that they can follow along with the dialogue as they're listening. So that's another idea that we've had. If listeners are interested in that, I'd like to know what the uptake might be on that before we do anything. That's one thing we're talking about. The other thing we're talking about is a stage play to bring the story to the stage in a way that it can be accessible by others in the communities across Canada and maybe even in the U.S. This is not an isolated story from an isolated place. It is ubiquitous across Canada. So that's another idea that we've had. And in any case, we're trying to collect the stories now so that we can continue to tell those kinds of stories and create awareness. And the other thing we're doing is we firmly believe that there could be some policy change with respect to how the legal profession and the medical profession becomes somewhat integrated in a foil against predation, this kind of predation. So we're discussing with a digital democracy platform. This platform is a web-based thing, but it really allows folks to engage in discussions around policy in a safe space, with the idea that from a focus group of maybe 100 people, some policy recommendations can come forward to the community at large, whether it's government decision makers or whether it's professional associations, to try and push for better policies to protect the more vulnerable elements of our society, given the $1 trillion that's likely to change hands in the next 5 years.
What is the best way for people to follow along with the story and hear the new episodes every week? And what is the best way for people to reach out and maybe share their own stories with you?
Yes. So thanks for that, Joe. TheMarkDoc.ca, T-H-E-M-A-R-K, D-O-C, all one word, .ca is the website. We're available on any of the major podcast platforms from Amazon, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. So if that's where you normally get your podcasts, if you search for Beware Mysterious Mark, you'll see us. And then there's links to the website from those various platforms. So that's the best way, I think, to listen to us. But in a shout out for radio, even though we're online station, the new episodes are available 7 p.m. Thursday nights from now till the beginning of July on radiosydney.ca.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on the doc or any of the info therein?
Well, it may sound a bit cliche, but open up conversations with your neighbors and your friends and your family about this. Talk about it as one way that awareness gets raised at the community level. And don't be afraid to stand up at one of your town council meetings and say, this concerns me. It's an element that I think we all should be aware of. And maybe your town council, it will support the awareness campaign that we're trying to drive. And of course, municipal and federal politicians, we're actively trying to engage those folks to make sure that in their ability to make decisions on things such as capacity, on vulnerability, on support for public awareness, on elder financial abuse, all of those things. Raising awareness, talking to people is the best way that you can thwart the predators that will no doubt be coming along.
Bill Collins, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me on this.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you for having me on.
Bill Collins is a producer on Beware Mysterious Mark. It's an audio drama billed as a harrowing true account of elder financial abuse. The 10-part series is airing Thursday nights on Radio Sydney through July. You can catch up on the episodes that are out so far at mark.radiosydney.ca.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Joe Calandino says his purpose these days is to help prevent young people from leading the life he used to live. A few decades back, Calandino was a full-patch member of the Hells Angels. Dealing with drug addiction and involved in a high-profile fight in a Kelowna casino in 2005, he was kicked out of the club. Later down the road, Calandino would reconnect with Sergeant Kevin Torvik, who was then working with a provincial outlaw motorcycle gang unit. Torvik and Calandino had also gone to high school together. According to Calandino's book, The Longest Road, that connection led Torvik to check in on his old schoolmate multiple times when Calandino was homeless in Vancouver and in and out of St. Paul's Hospital. During one visit to Calandino in a Surrey jail cell, the pair talked about the idea of Calandino working to help kids. Eventually, Torvik was able to get enough people on board, and Calandino made presentations about his story to various groups. He would meet his future wife, Brenda, a former school district principal. Joe and Brenda founded Yo Bro, Yo Girl, an initiative aimed at preventing youth violence and gang involvement. It runs programming with schools on the Lower Mainland. This week, Calandino was in Nanaimo to share his story with local students. On Monday, he presented at Barsby Secondary School. After taking in the presentation, I met up with Joe Calandino at White Rabbit Cafe.
I'm Joe Calandino, Executive Director of Yo Bro, Yo Girl Youth Initiative and co-founder. And I've also co-authored two books, the latest book, The Longest Road and To Hell and Back.
And you were here in Nanaimo at Barsby Secondary School talking with the students there. What was the message you were trying to get across?
Yeah, after living the life I led, being an ex-gang member, ex-full patch member of the Hells Angels, the key takeaways is, you know, I never want to see a child go through what I went through. And no child should ever see what I've seen, done what I've done, or, you know, lived a life they knew nothing about.
And when you're talking to kids, what is your approach? How are you trying to convey that and get that message across? What are you saying to them to do that?
Well, I walk them through my life, right? Every child needs to know they're not alone, right? Everybody faces adversity. Everybody has a struggle, right? And when I was growing up, I felt like I was all alone, right? I had a father who struggled with mental health, schizophrenia to be exact, right? And in the 70s, there are not the supports that there are today for families and children, right? It was, you know, a family from a European descent trying to cope and deal with somebody who struggled with extreme mental health, right? And they were not qualified, nor they tried to do it in a way of love, care, and, you know, tuck the child in. But really, that child, when it comes to, you know, kind of the family wanting to do it, they seek it elsewhere. And that's what we're seeing with our kids today, that sense of belonging, that sense of purpose, where they drift off and think they can find it from a friend or another place or another place, right? So, you know, the message is, you know, whatever adversity that you're facing today, right, they're so young in their lives that that adversity is just a blip.
Well, could you tell me what you know about as far as the pathways that young people kind of fall into gang life today in 2026? What are the ways that someone could get involved in that in the first place?
Well, now they set up shop in schools and playgrounds, which you heard today, which to me sickens me, right? How is it people are trying to get a product out on the street, you know, that today is killing people, and it's called fentanyl, carfentanil, acrofentanil. We've legalized, you know, marijuana. Kids are already struggling with addiction issues in grade 8. Come on. What have we done? So, you know, it's just for me, you know, if they're going to do their thing, they need to understand that you're playing with the adolescent brain. You have dopamine, serotonin, cognitive function, right? And you're throwing a substance into the body that misfires. The only one thing, if you poke out an eye, you know, nowadays they could put an eye back in the socket. You break an arm, you can break an arm, right? And they can repair it, a leg, a foot, an ankle, right? You lose an arm, they even have prosthetics. You damage your brain, now what? They don't replace a brain, right? And this is what's happening with our children today. They're not understanding that they're playing with the number one asset that we have, and that's our brain, right? And the body is a beautiful thing. I've recovered from battle injuries and wounds and addiction and all this stuff, but why go through that?
What is your philosophy on addiction, having gone through the experiences you have, as you've shared in both of your books and in your presentations to schools? You know, 20-odd years ago, you were dealing with addiction to cocaine and GHB. You managed to get past that. How do you frame addiction for people?
Well, in the way of framing addiction, that's a... that is a loaded question, and my wheelhouse is prevention, early intervention, right? You don't have to stop what you haven't started. And at the end of the day, right, we are dealing with now today, you know, a drug that is changing the very DNA of the human anatomy, right? And yes, addiction and people that struggle with addiction need the supports required, right? And you read my second book. I talked about my fall with alcohol, right? Immediately, I went to treatment, right? Understood things from a bigger perspective, right? And in the way of addiction, if somebody doesn't have purpose anymore and have lost their way, it's dark and ugly, the world that we as addicts lived in, okay? Or are still living in. And nobody's going to know what an addict deals with at all. We don't know their past trauma. We don't know their history. We don't know all these underlying issues for people that struggle today. And, you know, it's a big uphill battle. But having proper structure with purpose will give you something to look forward to. And when you seek something that gives you purpose, now you start to fill yourself with something different, opposed to not knowing, being lost, being dark, being in an ugly place, right? And it's giving them habilitation, right? And the good old word habilitation, right? Or rehabilitation, right? Teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime. Give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. So, I wish I had a magic wand and could wipe it away, but I don't. And this is only, and I have to speak from an I perspective when it comes to addiction, right? Because I don't know the other addict's issues. So, for me, this is what fulfilled me and gave me longevity on where I'm going in my life.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. We're hearing a conversation I had with Joe Calandino at White Rabbit Cafe in Nanaimo. Calandino is co-founder of Yo Bro, Yo Girl, which runs school programming on the Lower Mainland aimed at helping prevent youth from getting involved in gangs or other harmful activities. Calandino is a former member of the Hells Angels. He was in Nanaimo to speak with high school students about his life story and the journey that led him to Yo Bro Yo Girl. He's also told his story in a pair of books called To Hell and Back and The Longest Road. Both were co-authored by Gary Little, who was Calandino's high school counselor at Templeton Secondary School in Vancouver. A conversation with Calandino followed a presentation he made at Barsby Secondary School on Monday, May 25th. And you mentioned there that now your purpose in your work is focused on prevention for young people. You founded this initiative, Yo Bro, Yo Girl. Could you walk me through how exactly that works, what you do with kids to help try and prevent them from falling into that kind of gang lifestyle?
Well, it's not all me, right? There is a better half to Joe Calandino, and her name is Brenda, right? She was a district principal for a school district, right? And Brenda just filling me full of knowledge and understanding and, you know, that same day, same place, and, you know, having that activity with consistent messaging, right? And have a discussion. As adults, we have two ears, one mouth. You got to hear the kids. Don't judge with the mouth, right? So if we start to, sorry to say this, so forthcoming, shut our mouths and hear our children and have discussions, we can better understand where they're at without passing judgment. Then I call it playground syndrome. Do an activity, right? Kids have lost their way. They're no longer doing activities in parks and schools. I'm sure you used to play back in the day. Right now it's social, this, that, what have you. So we'll do an activity. We have a number of activities we'll bring to the kids. And then nothing is as good as a meal. Break bread. Right? And I do an art called Qigong, mindfulness, right? Brenda always is a big fan of mindfulness or a checkout. What is one takeaway? Or I take them through a Qigong meditation type exercise. And that 2-hour window is where our opportunity starts to develop that connection, relationship, in turn trust, for a program.
When you are doing a presentation, you shared that when you got involved with the gang life, it was something that you sought out. It was something that you kind of held in high esteem. You heard maybe from some of the questions from the students today, they were interested in seeing, like, oh, let me see the bike again.
Yeah, the fight scene and all this, that, whatever.
Yeah, how do you respond to that kind of interest in the bikes or the fights or the status when you hear you're at an assembly and you hear there are kids and maybe they think, like, oh, let me see that again. That seemed kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, you seen me debunk that right away, right? That fight scene that they wanted rewound, well, I got charged, convicted. Had to do time. Really? Was it that cool? And the bike scene. Yeah, sure. You know what I mean? If you want to ride a motorcycle responsibly and do it for the right reasons, right? I still love my Harley. I still ride my Harley today, right? Not everybody made the choice that I would make, right? I made that choice. So, you know, the life I led, they're kind of the Gangster Island theme I walked you through, right? Everybody thought it was, oh, cool. Well, prison. Oh, cool, Gangster Island, death, right? Oh, cool, Gangster Island, addiction. Those are your three outcomes from that lifestyle, right? And, you know, anybody that thinks they're going to live the Vita Loca when you're in that life, think about when you got to walk out that door. You, the Incredible Hulk. Because let me tell you something, if 45 bullets coming at you, you ain't no Hulk, right? And you fear that constantly, right? At least I did, so.
A lot of your programming is based on the lower mainland. Is there anything you can tell me about maybe what the situation is like on Vancouver Island versus the lower mainland when it comes to prevention of getting youth involved in gangs, or is there anything notably different about the situation?
I'm not very familiar. Nanaimo Ladysmith School District brought me out, so I believe they're being very proactive. You know, the administrator schools that I met with is hit the wow factor with me. At the alt-ed program in the current school, they're very proactive. They're getting invested with the children, right? And I just wish I could scale and grow Yobro to an all-time high, right? Because this model doesn't belong to Brenda and I. We would love to come in and say, here's how we did what we did. Now, if you want to go about doing this, this is what you require, right? But what I've seen out here so far, at least in Nanaimo, they're doing some real good work, like beyond good work. I'm pretty impressed.
There's a saying out there, the opposite of addiction is connection. I'm wondering if that's something you think of when you're doing your work, or what you think the role of kind of like social connection is in substance use or preventing substance use.
Three domains: connection, relationship. In turn, you develop trust. From there, you could create the conversation and create the journey. Three domains. That's what I teach my staff. Connection, relationship, gain their trust. Now we're building a foundation.
And that's like to be able to talk to a young person or get them to trust you to say, like, this is what I'm dealing with.
Open up.
What kind of impact have you seen from the work that you have done? Or what kind of stories could you share about maybe seeing young people open up?
Well, Kevin Torvik's most proud of one thing that we've really knocked it out of the ballpark with, and that is putting law enforcement into law enforcement. So whether it's an ex-participant, volunteer, people that have come across our program and got invested volunteering, we put over 25 people on the force as of today, wearing the badge, the gun, the uniform. How is it a gangster and cop come together and we create cops, right? And then
you shared that in your presentation, you share that you had a relationship with, well, a couple of relationships with people on the force. And, you know, while you were in your gang days, it wasn't a good relationship. I'm wondering if you could tell me how your kind of views on law enforcement maybe have evolved and what you think of it now.
Well, I talked about the hurdles that Kevin Torvik put in front of me. Hurdle one, he said, get down to whatever location, right? So I'm like, why? And he's like, just get down here. So I get down there. I hear a knock on the door. Okay? So knock on the door, knock, knock, knock. He goes, open the door. I'm like, what are you doing? I open the door. It's Brandon Steele. He wanted to see how I'd react, right? Me and Brandon Steele started talking. We've connected. Since then, we've become friends, right? He also did 8 years as one of my board of directors for Yo Bro Yo Girl, and we're still friends today. So, yeah, it's unique. My life, it's weird.
Well, I'm wondering if you could give me some perspective on whether or what roadblocks you face trying to do some of the work you do now, having a criminal record. Like what enabled you to get over that hurdle in the first place?
Well, the criminal record thing, right, will be with me. Of course, the pardon and everything, all that stuff comes into play, right? But the biggest hurdle is funding for charities, right? When you do this work, you're not the corporate sector, right? We rely on donor dollars or grants or things that can allow us to be sustainable, right? And, you know, everything leads back to money. If, you know, I had a pot of gold, I could scale and grow Yo Bro on a national scale within 5 to 8 years, right? But we don't, because you got to apply, you got to ask, you got to do donors. There's development stages, there's piloting, there's so many hurdles that we're up against. So,
how do you measure success? What are kind of the metrics you're tracking to say, like, what we're doing is
graduation.
Working?
We want to see kids graduate, right? From there, whether they move on to post-secondary, we develop small scholarships, youth leader models where we provide stipends, all that stuff. You know, it's just seeing a child achieve whatever they want to achieve and not getting involved with negative peer groups, right? Disconnecting from their family and ending up in the hands of law enforcement are three underpinnings.
And there's so much more we could get into on your story. There's a lot in there to cover. But maybe just before I let you go, is there anything else you think it's important people know about the work that you're doing today and your trip through Vancouver Island, the message you're trying to get across to the youth?
No, it's all about prevention, early intervention, right? And at the end of the day, as adults, you know, we got to stay invested with our children and, you know, understand where they're at. And, you know, we are hopeful that we can continue to do this good work, not only in Greater Vancouver, but maybe one day look at bringing it out to the island.
Joe Calandino, thank you very much for sitting down with me.
Thank you, Joe.
Joe Calandino is co-founder of Yo Bro, Yo Girl, which runs programming for youth in the Lower Mainland. A former member of the Hells Angels who was kicked out of the club, he was in Nanaimo to share his life story with youth at various local schools. We were speaking at White Rabbit Cafe following a presentation by Calandino at Barsby Secondary School on Monday, May 25th. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. Reminder, you can find past interviews from the show on our podcast feed, and you can track that down on our social media pages. Just search People First Radio on Facebook or Instagram or Blue Sky. Thank you very much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.